The economic crisis had many causes, but high on just about every expert's list is securitization. It's one of those little-understood financial concepts that touch the lives of nearly everyone. The credit cards you use are securitized. So are your student loans. Even the music you listen to can be securitized. Debts get bundled up into securities and then sold to investors. Congress and the Obama administration are working on measures that would change the way this market works. As part of our series called The Future of Capitalism, NPR's Jim Zaroli explains securitization with a little help from James Brown.
Oh, I feel good!
I'm sitting here now with David Pullman, who's an investment banker and the creator of Pullman Bonds. Pullman Bonds are a way of securitizing what?
A Pullman Bond's a securitization of it. Music, royalties, entertainment, royalties, assets, and other intellectual property.
So Pullman has figured out a way to take music royalties earned by people like Ashford and Simpson, David Bowie and the late James Brown, and convert them into a bond. The investor gets to invest in the music business. The musician gets a big wad of cash up front. Securitization as we know it got underway about 40 years ago. Until then, if you wanted a mortgage, you went to your local bank, and if it felt good about your credit record, it dipped into its own funds and gave you a loan. Then mortgage lenders discovered they could sell their mortgages. Big investment banks were buying them up and turning them into securities.
This was a big breakthrough that allowed a lot more money to come into the mortgage market than had ever been there before.
Alyssa Katz is the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. She says once lenders began converting their mortgages into securities that could be traded like a stock or bond, big institutional investors like pension funds couldn't get enough of them. They bought everything they could see. Suddenly, lenders were inundated with cash. A lot of new mortgage lenders sprung up. George Miller, president of the American Securitization Forum, says this was a good thing.
The ultimate beneficiary, I think, has been the consumer or the business who's had another source of financing available to them, often at more competitive rates. And overall, those things are good for economies. They're good for societies.
But the boom would eventually lead to new problems. Lenders found the demand for mortgage-backed securities was so intense they could unload just about anything, even risky subprime debt. And because of that, they never had to hold the mortgages on their books very long, so they didn't have to worry too much about whether the people they lent to could pay back their loans. Attorney and securitization expert Jason Kravitz says some of these loans caused problems.
I think that as an industry, we were sloppy in subprime mortgages. We didn't have adequate credit standards for originating the mortgages. We didn't have strong enough due diligence. There wasn't enough transparency in the marketplace.
In poor neighborhoods like this one in Brooklyn, the result has been a sad and by now familiar story. Writer Alyssa Katz says people were encouraged to take out loans they couldn't afford. Money was there for the taking.
And by that I mean if you had borrowers buying a home for the first time who didn't necessarily know what it involved, who were trying to reach for the American dream, you would have an opportunity for mortgage lenders, brokers, real estate agents to take advantage.
Today, the street where Katz and I are standing has one of the highest foreclosure rates in New York City. For sale signs and abandoned houses are everywhere. And residents like Marie Emanuel have seen the impact of that up close.
Every block, maybe you see a house or, you know, foreclosed and banks taking over. You know, it's just a depressing scene, period.
Many critics now believe that the mortgage meltdown and the recession itself simply wouldn't have happened if the securitization market had been better regulated. One idea floated by the Obama administration has been to require securitizers to hold on to a small piece of whatever product they're selling. That way they'd be a little more careful about the loans they make, says investment banker David Pullman.
If you have an equity piece in something, if you have your own investment in it, you may, and you have that risk, you'll maybe trade a little differently. You'll be more conservative.
Pullman says there's also a problem with the rating agencies, whose job is to analyze securities for investors. He says they often gave passing grades to some of the worst products. Right now, he says the business is dominated by two or three major players. He says more competition would be a good thing. Even the securitization industry agrees that reforms are needed. Again, George Miller of the American Securitization Forum.
I think those criticisms are legitimate. There are steps that both the government and the industry is taking to address them.
And the industry has no choice but to take the problem seriously. With the recession, the securitization market fell off a cliff. Today, parts of the industry are improving, but the once vibrant market for mortgage-backed securities remains on life support. If the housing business is really to improve, the industry will have to convince investors the securities market is safe again. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Errol Morris made that documentary, The Fog of War, out of his 20 hours of interviews with Robert McNamara. He joins us now from Boston. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You were probably privy to more of Robert McNamara's introspection than anyone but close friends or relatives. What do you think he made of his role in history?
To him, it was an ongoing investigation, trying to figure out what had gone wrong, what he had been thinking, and moreover, how we could learn lessons from history and perhaps prevent the same things from happening all over again. Very, very sad because the same things were happening all over again at the time that I was making the movie with him.
In Iraq, you're saying.
Yes.
I want to play something that McNamara told you about in the documentary about working in World War II under Curtis LeMay, who 20 years later would urge nuclear war over the Soviet missiles in Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis. In the firebombing of Japan, which McNamara worked on with LeMay, McNamara said they burnt to death 100,000 civilians in Tokyo in one night.
LeMay said if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals. And I think he's right. He, and I'd say I, were behaving as war criminals.
He had confronted questions of responsibility for war long before Vietnam, it sounds.
I believe that's correct, yes. This remark came at the very beginning of my series of interviews with him. Quite a surprising remark, not with respect to Vietnam, but a war criminal with respect to the firebombing of Japan. And this issue of responsibility and of his culpability is something that never left him. It was with him throughout his life.
But here's another cut from The Fog of War. In the epilogue, you ask McNamara if he felt responsible for Vietnam, and here's what he said.
I don't want to go into further discussion. It just opens up more controversy. I don't want to add anything to Vietnam. It is so complex that anything I say will require additions and qualifications.
Isn't the feeling that you're damned if you do and if you don't, no matter what you
say? Yeah, that's right. And I'd rather be damned if I don't.
That was a pretty central question about his career and what lessons he learned from it, for him to be so resistant to answering you.
He has tried to answer that question in so many different ways. I'm not sure that it has a question with any definite answer. It's something that he was clearly wrestling with when I talked with him. And the puzzle, the mystery of it all is increased certainly by listening to these taped conversations between Johnson and McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
McNamara is often thought of as the hawk, Johnson the dove. But to me, those conversations tell a very different story.
When McNamara began writing and talking about Vietnam more candidly, it was in the 1990s. It was 30 years after the fact. And many people criticized him, saying that if he had made these acknowledgments even in the 1970s, when the country was still so divided over the war, that it might have been more significant, but that might have required his exile from the Washington establishment.
It's something for which many people can never forgive him. Not for the role in orchestrating the war, but his silence following his departure from the Defense Department. He told me a very odd and interesting story. that he and McGeorge Bundy had come to Humphrey.
Hubert Humphrey, they said.
Hubert Humphrey, who was running for president of the United States, and said that they would come out with him. Together, they would come out against the war if Humphrey would declare his opposition as well. Humphrey said, I have to speak to Johnson first. And he went off to meet with the president. President, according to McNamara, must have heard why Humphrey had come for this visit and kept him waiting for 4 or 5 hours. And during that time, Humphrey lost his nerve. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. But another fantastically interesting story that I heard from this man. Why didn't he speak out? Here's another question for you. Why didn't he speak out against the Iraq War when he expressed to me on so many, many occasions his opposition to what was happening?
Errol Morris, filmmaker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now to the latest in our occasional series on water in the West. California is in one of its worst droughts in decades, and Los Angeles has restricted how much water residents can use. There's also a force patrolling the streets and lawns looking for serial water wasters. NPR's Ben Bergman went on a ride-along with what some are calling the L.A. water cops.
It's a typically sunny, dry day in L.A., and we've just closed the doors to our patrol car, a blue Toyota Prius. The driver is David Jones, one of 15 water conservation representatives from the Department of Water and Power. Working for the city for a quarter century, he hasn't missed a day.
Perfect attendance since the day I started.
Never been sick.
I'm pretty proud of that.
Jones' Prius has no siren or radio. He's armed with only a clipboard and pamphlets. His uniform, black pants, and a yellow polo shirt.
What we're going to do is we're going to respond to customer complaints that have come in via email or telephone. And en route, if we see any violators, we're going to stop and educate or issue a citation.
Residents are banned from cleaning sidewalks with hoses. They can only water their lawns after 4 or before 9. Sprinklers are limited to Mondays and Thursdays, but only before 9 or after 4. Got it? Outside this apartment complex, the sprinklers are turned up so high, water not only floods the lawn, but covers much of the sidewalk.
For the citizens who have to come up and down the street here, they have to walk through this.
Time to find the offender.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, my name is Mr. Jones, Department of Water and Power. The reason why I stopped is because we did receive a complaint that your sprinklers are on during prohibited hours of the day. Were you aware of the time of the day?
Twice a week.
Yeah, twice a week for the sprinklers, yes, but...
The sprinklers twice a week.
Yeah, but the hours.
Since it's the man's first offense, Jones lets him off with just a warning. If he finds him illegally watering again, there will be fines as high as $600 for repeated violations. For now, Jones tries a gentler touch.
Could you tell a friend, a relative, and your neighbors about the ordinance that we have? Because we're really running out of water in Los Angeles.
A short time later, Jones responds to another complaint. He approaches a gardener who abruptly puts down his hose after seeing the badge dangling from Jones's neck.
How you doing?
Right.
Okay. I guess you know why I stopped.
Since the gardener is just a worker, Jones knocks on the door of the house to talk to the owner.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay.
The reason why I stopped is that I noticed that your gardener was watering, and he's watering during prohibited hours.
I know. You can see my water bill. I don't use that much water.
That way?
Really?
Yeah.
You can look at it and see. I don't
I would be able to pull it up, but actually that's not part of my job.
I only pay less than $15 for my water, and here everybody else has hundreds of dollars.
Yeah,
really try not to use it.
Yeah.
You know, he's just helping me by watering because everything is getting yellow.
Jones says he loves his job, even though the people he encounters often dread a visit from him. The water conservation program certainly isn't without its critics.
It's a soggy mess to me. I think it's a stupid program. It makes me angry just to think about it.
Diana Chapman is a community activist. She says she's all for conservation, but from her point of view, the city is encouraging citizens to rat out their neighbors.
I don't want to be telling on my neighbors. I want to keep them as neighbors and have them as friends. I don't want to be going, hey, the city of LA is saying they're using too much water.
For the city's response, we went straight to the top of the imposing water and power headquarters downtown to meet with CEO David Nahai.
Most people report wasteful practices because they genuinely believe that waste is occurring. This isn't somebody snitching as such. It's really Angelenos banding together to deal with a problem that confronts all of us.
Nahai says he hopes to avoid a total ban on watering lawns with the current restrictions. And before we leave his office, he's kind enough to offer some refreshment.
Would you like some water? We do have some, you know.
Unfortunately, not nearly enough. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The final match at Wimbledon yesterday was one for the history books. Roger Federer of Switzerland won his 15th Grand Slam title, eclipsing the mark set previously by Pete Sampras. And it was a remarkable match between Federer and American Andy Roddick. They battled for more than 4 hours, and it was finally decided in an extraordinary fifth set, as heard in this tape provided by NBC Sports.
And Federer stands alone.
To hear more, we called the tennis correspondent for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, Christopher Clary. He was there at Wimbledon yesterday. Good morning. Lucky
you. Good morning.
There were a number of special moments in this fifth set. Tell us about it.
Well, this, first of all, was unprecedented. There's never been a fifth set this long in the entire history of Grand Slam tennis, which is quite a statement because it goes back to Wimbledon in 1877. But of the many critical moments in the fifth set, the biggest from Federer's perspective was probably at 8-all when he was serving and he was down 2 break points at 15-40, and he managed to save those. And Roddick had no way of knowing it at the time, but there would be no more break points for him in the match. And it was just a question of Roger playing just a little bit better, serving a little bit more consistently, and maybe being just a bit more confident down the stretch. And it finally ended with a forehand error by Roddick.
Both these players are exceptionally good servers. Tell us how that shaped this match and what tipped it in favor of Roger Federer.
Roger Federer probably served better in this match than he's ever served in a big match. It was grass, which is a server's surface, but Roger served 50 aces, which is by far the most he's ever served in a match during his life. Roddick was also phenomenal, held his serve 37 times in a row, which I think it's safe to say has never been done before. And he lost it on the 38th, was the more successful server overall. But down the end, when the nerves were at their most intense, he cracked, and Roger didn't, and that makes the difference.
And then this new record that Roger Federer has set with 15 Grand Slam titles, he did it right in front of Pete Sampras.
It's true. Pete and Roger have developed a real friendship, a genuine friendship. They played exhibitions together in the last year or so. And I think Roger really wanted to reach out to Pete in a lot of ways and get to know him. And I think as bittersweet as it truly was for Pete, I think he had made a promise to Roger that he would be there when the record was hanging in the balance, and he kept his promise.
Let's turn for a moment to Andy Roddick, who really did come prepared. He hired a new coach last year. He lost some weight, sharpened his focus. By the end of the match, the crowd was sort of chanting for him. Here he is after the match from tape provided by NBC Sports.
It was a pleasure playing here today in front of great champions like Pete, Manolo, Rod, and Bjorn there. I still hope one day that my name will be up there with theirs as winner of this tournament, and I'll be back.
He was speaking in front of past Wimbledon winners, as you could hear, and as we mentioned, Pete Sampras, although for the moment, the tennis belongs to Roger Federer.
The crowd at Wimbledon generally is very pro-Federer. They like his game, they like his style. But by the end of the match, I think they would have been equally happy to see Andy Roddick win the match, and he equally deserved it, frankly. But Roger is clearly the best player. It's amazing how fast it's switched back again, Renee, because a year ago, Rafael Nadal beat Roger in a great Wimbledon final. He reduced him to tears in Australia in January when he beat him and dominated him again other times throughout the last year. And here we are, less than 6 months, 7 months since he lost in Australia, and he's back on top. So it does change fast in tennis, and we really are in a golden age right now in the men's sport.
Christopher Clary is the tennis correspondent for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Renee.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Farming on Facebook, a surge of web browser updates, and an online musical called Website Story. We'll have those tech stories in just a few minutes, all with our regular tech guide, Omar Gayaga. But first, this story. 48 million Arabic speakers connect via the web. But here's one big disconnect. Very little content is actually written in Arabic. Now, a new technology is transforming the way Arabic-speaking people use the Internet, as Philip Martin reports.
Rasha Abdullah, a professor of mass communication at American University in Cairo, Egypt, has written two entire books on the subject of Arabic content on the Internet.
That's something that we're suffering severely from. The Arabic content on the Internet right now is less than 1%, and it's obviously very dismal.
Professor Abdullah said that of her 500 Egyptian students, 78% have never typed in Arabic online, a fact that greatly disturbed Habib Haddad, a Boston-based software engineer originally from Lebanon.
I mean, imagine 78% of French people don't type French. Imagine how destructive that is, the language online.
And that's why Haddad began working on Yamli.
Yamli is inspired from the word yumli, which means dictate, to dictate your words.
Yamli co-developer Imad Yaradini explains how it works.
The idea is that if you don't have an Arabic keyboard, you can type Arabic by spelling your words out phonetically. For example, just think of when you're writing the word falafel. Yamli will convert that to Arabic in your web browser. We will go and search not only the Arabic script version of that search query, but also for all the Western variations of that keyword.
Gerardini, a MIT-trained software engineer of American-Lebanese descent, says in addition to solving the ability of native Arabic speakers to search and write in their own language, Yamli can also be used to teach Arabic to non-Arabic speakers. That's how Nassim Khalid, a teaching fellow at Harvard, is using the technology.
Well, typically an intermediate student, they can write in Arabic by hand, but they have no idea how to type in Arabic. So we were writing one-act plays a few weeks ago, and I sent them all this link to Yamli so they would be able to type quickly and easily.
And the word is getting out. At this recent new technology forum at MIT, Yamli went on to win Best of Show, a development that did not escape the attention of Google, which recently developed its own Arab search and transliteration engine.
I guess Google recognizes a good idea when it sees it.
Yamli co-developer Imad Gerardini.
And the way we counter it is by being better. We live and breathe Yamli every day, and we're constantly in the process of improving how people can use it.
Since its release more than a year ago, Arab web specialists say that Yamli has helped increase Arabic content on the Internet just by its use. They say that bodes well for the Arabic web and for better communication between the Arab and Western worlds. For NPR News, I'm Philip Martin in Boston, Massachusetts.